Welcome to the Pathways podcast for the American Society for Cell Biology. My name is Mary Spiro. Our guest is Doug Sear, professor of cell biology at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Thanks for being with me today, Doug.
Thanks for having me.
Tell me a little bit about the background of your work.
Yeah, so we work on mechanisms for function of the HSP70 system in protein homeostasis. And there is a family of cofactors or co-chaperones that specify HSP70 function, and they're known as HSP40 proteins. And there's a subset of HSP40s that are associated with the cytoplasmic face of the endoplasmic reticulum. And we've been interested for the past 20 years in understanding how ER-associated HSP40s recruit cytosolic HSP70 to function on the cytoplasmic face of the ER. And one of the jobs that HSP70s and 40s do on the cytoplasmic face of the ER is facilitate the biogenesis of polytopic membrane proteins. So we're trying to understand how molecular chaperones facilitate the folding of membrane proteins and also detect misfolded membrane proteins and help the cell dispose of them.
Now, that basic science that you're doing, that basic cell biology, has implications for people in the real world, namely people with lung disorders like cystic fibrosis. Can you tell me a little bit about how it's associated with cystic fibrosis?
So in our studies, our basic studies, we use membrane protein clients that have disease relatedness. And one of the clients that we work on is the cystic fibrosis transmembrane conductance regulator, also known as CFTR. CFTR is a large protein, has 1,480 amino acids. It has two transmembrane regions and three cytoplasmic subdomains that take about 10 minutes to synthesize, and they need to interact together to form an ion channel that can escape recognition by ER quality control machines to escape the ER and reach the cell surface. It turns out that the folding of CFTR is rather inefficient. Only about 20 to 30% of the wild type protein that's made can fold and reach the plasma membrane to function. And there are disease related mutations that cause cystic fibrosis. And normally, the wild type CFTR protein functions as a cyclic AMP-gated chloride ion channel. So the channel is opened in response to phosphorylation of its regulatory domain and hydrolysis of ATP by its different nucleotide binding domains. And when it opens, it permits conductance of chloride down its concentration gradient from inside the cell to outside the cell. And that regulates hydration of the airway surfaces and surfaces of glands in the body.
So in the lungs, the digestive tract, it keeps the mucus thin.
Yeah, salt glands. It keeps things hydrated, and so you don't get a lot of mucus plugs and bacterial infections and
right.
Things like that.
And in a cystic fibrosis patient, that would not function properly, and so you would have an accumulation of that.
Yeah, in CF, the hydration is defective. Mucus gets really thick. The cilia that would normally swirl the mucus and help clear bacteria from lungs becomes jammed up, and you get mucus plugs in the airways, and that fosters infection. And eventually the infection causes fibrotic damage to lungs.
So the majority of CF patients are dealing with an F508 mutation, correct? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, F508-DEL, the deletion of F508.
Okay. But you're dealing with a different kind of mutation. Tell me about that.
About 70% of CF patients have at least one copy of delta F508, and they oftentimes are heterozygotes, and they have another allele. And there's maybe 30 or 40 alleles that are commonly inherited alongside delta F. And the mutation that's the sort of focus of this paper is a mutation of asparagine 1-303 to a lysine, which, and that's located in NBD2. So it's at the C terminus of the protein, whereas the F508 del is in NBD1 and it's more N terminal. So the N1-303 decay mutation causes a late stage folding defect, and the protein behaves differently in functional assays and also in cell biological assays.
In your paper, you describe the CFTR protein as it's multi has different components to it. And because it's a late stage misfolding, what happens that causes the problem in recognizing that it's a misfolded protein?
The data that we have suggests that in Delta F508, folding initiates, but because of the problem with the folding of NBD1 caused by the F508 deletion, the protein accumulates in a globally misfolded conformation. Doesn't have a significant amount of secondary structure or tertiary structure that limits its that would limit recognition by molecular chaperones or prevent it from being easily extracted from the endoplasmic reticulum and delivered to the proteasome. The
Right. So
N1
it's easy to recognize as wrong.
right, yeah, there's a it's globally misfolded. And so with N1-303 decay, the data that we have suggests that it initiates folding and progresses along its folding pathway until a terminal protein assembly event needs to take place. That causes a partially assembled or a stable intermediate form of N1-303 to accumulate. And the cell seems to have a hard time dealing with stable intermediates of membrane proteins. So they intermediates, those types of intermediates of N1-303 decay seem to be degraded by a different pathway that involves the autophagy system versus the ER-associated degradation system.
And that's the crux of your paper, basically.
Yeah, so the crux of the paper is with the development of protein folding modulators that can restore the conditional folding defects in F508 del CFTR by Vertex Pharmaceuticals and also by AbbVie and a couple of other companies. There is a and their emergence as drugs that are used in the clinic, there's a push to try to restore function to all CF causing CFTR mutants. And in screening of collections of those mutants, we identified N1-303 decay as a protein that is actually stabilized by the same modulators that repair or restore function of F508 del, but the stabilized form of the protein doesn't exhibit a very large amount of activity. There's no real clinical significance to the action of the drugs on N1-303 decay. And we also found that it accumulates in auto lysosomes instead of being degraded by the cytosolic proteasome. So there appeared to be different routes for turnover of delta F508 versus N1-303 decay. So the focus of the paper is to try to understand what's wrong with N1-303 decay CFTR and then define the mechanism by which the cell triages the stable intermediates of N1-303 decay CFTR to ER-associated autophagy pathway versus the ER-associated degradation pathway.
So you've been working on this problem for several years. What did you discover in this latest research?
Well, our initial observations about differences in mechanisms for triage of misfolded membrane proteins came in 2014 in studies on some G protein coupled receptors, where we found that a stable intermediate of a GPCR was degraded by an ER-associated autophagy pathway versus ERAD. And with that observation, we wanted to identify additional clients. And we wanted to identify steps in the pathway that would help describe the mechanism of action. And so in this paper, what we identified are HSP70 and a ER-associated HSP40 called DNA JB12. as triage factors for CFTR degradation intermediates that accumulate in different conformations. The JB12 and HSP70 protein help degrade CFTR by ER-associated degradation through interactions with a E3 ubiquitin ligase called RNF5 or RMA1. We also found that stable intermediates of N1-303 decay are delivered to the autophagy system by the same complex. And it looks to us like the HSP70 and the HSP40 deliver the client to local autophagy initiation machineries where the membrane protein is actually integrated into the membranes of specialized membranes called phagophores that eventually become autophagosomes. So it looks like the 70s and 40 facilitate direct sorting of membrane proteins in the ER into phagophores. And that's highlighted in figure 7C of our paper.
We'll return to the Pathways podcast after these brief announcements. Here's what's happening at the American Society for Cell Biology this month. Election results are in, and Erica Holzbauer has been elected to serve as the president of ASCB for 2023. See all election results on ascb.org. It's award season, and ASCB has awards for every career stage. Nominate a deserving colleague or even yourself. Most awards applications close May 17th. There are two awards that close June 30th. Check out the Awards and Grants tab on our website for more information. June 11th is the deadline for our Compass Outreach Grants. You could receive $1,000 for a project that promotes science outreach and public engagement. Visit the Grants and Awards tab on our website to learn more. ASCB offers a full spectrum of webinars that are free for anyone to view live. Visit the Meetings and Events tab on our website to see which ones might interest you. Our online community forum is the place to be to join the conversation. Visit community.ascb.org to read what people are talking about or to ask your own question. That's it for this month. Now back to the show.
You mentioned in your paper this VX-809. That's a modulator drug?
Yeah, Vertex-809 is a class 1 folding modulator, and it's a relative to Vertex-661, which is used in a triple modulator therapy in the clinic. And so what we found is that if we stabilize delta F508 CFTR with Vertex-809, it would spare some of the delta F from degradation and promote its accumulation in the folded form that ends up at the plasma membrane. In contrast, if we stabilize N1-303 decay CFTR, we promote its sorting into the ER-associated autophagy pathway, which is interesting because you could stabilize an intermediate instead of restoring its function, you actually stimulate flux through an alternative pathway for turnover.
So does a CF patient ever have both of these mutations?
Yeah, the delta F508 N1-303 decay CF patients are detected in the clinic. And N1-303 decay is one of the most common non-delta F508 mutations. There are also patients that have the N1-303 decay homozygous recessive genotype.
So you're saying that the drug, the VX-809, stabilizes the more common mutation so that the CFTR can function properly, but it also kicks the rare mutation over to degradation. Is that correct?
Okay. Yeah. So there are different rate limiting steps in the folding pathways for the delta F508 CFTR versus the N1-303 decay CFTR. And the folding modulators can overcome the rate limiting step caused by the deletion of F508. And the N1-303 decay is recognized or is bound by the drug, and the drug actually stabilizes N1-303 decay. And it promotes the folding of the N-terminal regions of N1-303 decay. But because the mutation is in the sort of C-terminal part of the protein, the drug doesn't repair its proper folding. It stabilizes the intermediate, but doesn't restore folding to a conformation that can escape. And we think what happens is if you accumulate a misfolded ion channel in the membrane of the endoplasmic reticulum, you could cause some leakage of calcium or some membrane damage. And that would initiate apoptosis because the cell reacts strongly to the accumulation of too much calcium in the cytosol. So we think that low-level membrane damage caused by the accumulation of these partially assembled stable intermediates might be the trigger to initiate flux and clearance of the stabilized intermediates from the ER as a protective mechanism from the induction of apoptosis.
So it sort of sounds, though, that you've progressed the treatment of CF, like you have found a new pathway, a new potential therapeutic pathway for CF.
I think some of the data in the paper, at the front end of the story, where we look at the ion channel function of N1-303 decay, what we found is that the N1-303K is largely resistant to functional correction by just the folding modulator. But what we did find is if we cool cells down, we can and add folding modulators that we can isolate from purified membrane patches, functional CFTR channels, suggesting that even though the N1-303 decay is resistant to functional correction by Vertex 809, its function can be corrected. And it could be that the use of a folding modulator like Vertex 809 and an additional approach that fixes the problem with the late stage assembly N1-303K could give some therapeutic benefit.
This just really sounds like a pretty complex problem that still has a lot of questions to be answered.
Yeah, a big problem is we don't have a structure. We don't have a high resolution three-dimensional structure of CFTR. So we don't really know how the modulators bind or how they act. We have biochemical data that suggests mechanisms, but we don't have an image showing where the drug binds and how the drug stabilizes. And the problem with that is the regulatory domain on CFTR is intrinsically disordered, and it's going to be difficult to get a crystal structure. It's possible that cryo-EM could be used, but it's also going to be an issue because it's likely that there would be off-pathway intermediates in the collection of images that you'd see, because it's hard to overexpress CFTR.
And you have a hard time sorting through all of that.
Yeah.
Well, so what else do you want people to know about this paper?
Well, I think for us, what we'd like to share is the identification of the intermediates of the N1-303K protein as they move out of the ER into the lysosome. There's a system called ER phagy that helps degrade damaged endoplasmic reticulum. And there are six different ER phagy receptors. And when we identified the route taken by G protein couple receptors from the ER to the lysosome, we always saw the intermediates in the membranes of lysosomes versus in the lumen. And we never saw intermediates in ER membranes that have been engulfed by lysosomes. So we thought there was a different pathway. We inactivated all the ER phagy receptors and never found that they were necessary or sufficient to support flux of stable intermediates of misfolded membrane proteins to the lysosome. So what we did was in figure 3 and in figure 5 of the paper, we used markers for the autophagy pathway and asked if we could detect N1-303 decay in association with autophagy initiation machinery in omegasomes prior to passage out of the ER into lysosomes. And we identified intermediates that interact with a protein called WIPI, which marks autophagy initiation sites in the ER. We demonstrated that the autophagy initiation kinase subunit FIP200 localizes on ER tubules that contain N1-303-decay, which suggests that autophagy initiation machinery is facilitating flux through the pathway, which is different than ER phagy, because in ER phagy, there are receptors that are inside the ER membrane that are bound by preformed phagophores that allow for the ER to be engulfed. So the data that we have is consistent with focal activation of flux of the membrane protein into membranes of phagophores while they're being formed in the ER versus a preformed phagophore eating the ER that contains the membrane protein. So we think that the microscopy in the paper will advance the field's understanding of how stable intermediates of membrane proteins are degraded in the absence of nonspecific degradation of ER tubules. So we think it's a chaperone-mediated focal regulation of flux into a specialized autophagy system. Kind of a lot to swallow there.
Yeah.
But I think figure 7C helps. And there are a number of reviews on ER phagy and sort of compare our model with some of the information that's out there on ER phagy.
I think you've provided a very nice walkthrough through your paper that will be in Molecular Biology of the Cell. What's next?
Well, right now, we're interested in understanding the mechanism by which the accumulation of stable intermediates of misfolded membrane proteins is sensed. In the paper, we showed that the DNA JB12 is required for entry of the stable intermediates into omegasomes, these autophagy initiation sites. But we don't know how that works. We don't know why it's required. We know it is required. And we have some information that we published in our earlier molecular cell paper suggesting that the JB12 interacts with subunits of the autophagy initiation kinase complexes. So we're trying to figure out if the J protein can sense the substrates or if long-term association of these stable intermediates trigger activation of the autophagy initiation kinases to mediate flux through the pathway. And we need to understand how the membrane proteins selectively get sorted into the membranes of phagophores. I mean, we can accumulate N1-303-decay CFTR in the ER, and the ER also contains a membrane chaperone called calnexin. But we do not see calnexin in the membranes of the phagophores that contain the substrate. So there's a selection step that takes place that excludes one type of ER membrane protein, but not the misfolded type. So there's a selection mechanism, there's a segregation mechanism that we need to identify. And we're also interested in understanding how a membrane protein that's in a ER-associated phagophore leaves. We can see the intermediates in phagophore membranes, but we haven't been able to capture the conversion of the phagophores into autophagosomes that eventually fuse with lysosomes. And we have an image in the paper showing the association of a lysosome with ER membranes. And it looks like there are small possible autophagosomes that are sort of budding off the surface of phagophores that interact with lysosomes. And it could be that small autophagosomes are mediating the transfer event. Normally, autophagosomes in starved cells are bigger than lysosomes. And the autophagosomes that we think we see might be in the 50 to 100 nanometer size range, which is kind of at the level of our detection right now. So in the future, we're trying to improve our imaging approaches to try to visualize the transfer. So we're interested in entry of the substrate into the autophagy membrane system, and then also transfer of the protein out of phagophores and into lysosomes. And that's actually a really complicated question. And generally people in the field don't have a good idea of how phagophores are formed. And they don't have a great idea about how phagophores are. Normally phagophores are like three-dimensional spheres that have one opening on one side, and they don't know how they fuse to form a sealed autophagosome. So some of the issues that we're addressing speak to a specific quality control mechanism, but they also have general implications about how, you know, the autophagy system works in all processes. So those are some difficult questions, but we think we have the imaging techniques, and as our ability to get higher and higher resolution images and accumulate different intermediates improves, I think that we will be able to answer some of those questions. And a final thing is, one thing that we're doing that's different than other people are doing is we're using a fluorescently tagged membrane protein as a marker for autophagic membranes in starved cells or in situations where people look at degradation of damaged mitochondria and things like that. They're really only looking at the engulfment of the cargo and entry of the cargo into the autophagy system. The membrane proteins that we study that are fluorescently tagged allow us to look at the early steps in the formation of a phagophore membrane, because they all contain the substrate. And so we can follow the birth of a phagophore and from a ER tubule. The data we have suggests that ER tubules that contain the substrates enter the omegasome, and then somehow they're modified and converted into phagophores and then autophagosome. So it could be that some of the information we generate in the future will have some novel components to it because of the approach that we're using being different.
Well, that's really fascinating stuff. Thanks so much for talking with me, Doug.
Thanks for your interest.
The Pathways Podcast is a production of the American Society for Cell Biology. Thanks for listening.